All right, here we are, live on air with Brandon Heavey in his empty, sparse home, his echo chamber.
They call Steve Jobs a fit. One piece of furniture in the house.
Yeah, well, you know what, man? It's the danger of actually moving to a new state, a new level of elevation, all that kind of stuff, is you end up with an empty room that you're inside of, and that's okay. We won't judge you. We'll admire your minimalism and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I promise I'm not a serial killer.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So I'll give a quick intro here. Some of you guys have probably encountered Brandon before, since I know that he sent out some information on this webinar. So some of you guys may work with him, some of you guys may know him. And I have also interviewed Brandon on my podcast. That was like a year or so ago, and I've been on Brandon's podcast. We've had a great time just setting up microphones and talking to each other. So Brandon is someone who I met at an OPEX course. Which one was it? It was one of the level two ones, right?
Yeah, I can't remember which one, but I think I've seen you out there a couple of times now. I think they'll do.
Yeah, for sure. So we've got some shared interest in intense levels of continuing education and trying to figure out what's actually going on in fitness. And Brandon does some coaching work. He used to own a CrossFit gym, looks at people's lab tests, and he's doing some extremely intense continuing education, kind of digging deeper into lab testing and all that sort of stuff. And Brandon, like myself, also is not necessarily like a jock who has trained in fitness his whole life and kind of got into this. Brandon, what's your actual degree in?
Computer and electrical engineering.
Okay, great. Yeah, so I have a chemical engineering degree, so definitely coming into fitness from a much more like nerdy and analytical state of mind. Brandon is also a guy who can like write a bunch of computer code to do stuff, which he's helped me with a few times since I've been trying to learn how to do various items like that. So, you know, some solid similarities in terms of our personality type and our, I guess, our journey and as far as figuring out what we're doing in fitness and trying to coach people. So topic for today, which I think is really interesting, especially for some more analytically minded folks, is overtraining and lab testing and all that kind of stuff, right? Because I think that there's so much just nonsense going on with the way people talk about these types of things, especially relative to lab tests and like, okay, spit in this tube, we're going to look at your cortisol level, and we're going to tell you that you need to take like 10 different supplements and your B vitamins are all screwed up. And, you know, there's all this kind of stuff that, to me, as someone who I guess has a little bit more of a skeptical bent and has done some, you know, has a background in science, I'm kind of like, well, okay, hold on a second here. Like, what are we talking about? Are these tests repeatable? Are the labs reliable? Do you get the same results if you send the same spit to a few different labs? Do your cortisol levels in your saliva actually align with anything? Does it correlate with blood levels? You know, how sensitive is this test? What's the standard deviation? Can you actually make any real recommendations based upon these results? Like, I don't believe you in general. That's kind of the, I guess, the framework that I sort of approach these types of things with. And I know that you've done a lot more than I have as far as researching this type of stuff. But I think that both of us as coaches have seen in real life something that looks like overtraining, maybe just, you know, some sort of negative adaptation to stress over time, including training. But, you know, it's an interesting gray area where there's, you know, empirically very clearly something real going on when athletes end up overtrained, where they are just incapable of performing at the level that they should be performing at. But what that actually means as far as the lab testing, you know, the supplement protocols, the best practices in terms of getting people to feel better, like, you know, I think that it's kind of unclear, and I think you probably have a better idea than most people and have said a lot of stuff that makes more sense than most people on these topics. So, you know, we're here to learn from you.
Yeah, I think that it's really unclear. And I think the people that say it's not unclear probably haven't really branched out and dug into the research as much as maybe they should have. I don't really think that there's answers per se on overtraining or any of this lab work stuff. It's all pretty new. There's a lot of research around it. Nothing that's super comprehensive and definitive. And so I think really the theme for these topics that we're going to talk about today is a gray area. So at the end, you know, maybe you'll have a couple answers, but you probably have a lot more questions than answers. And I think that, you know, Todd and I, we're similar in that we're really bad about marketing ourselves and being like, yeah, we'll definitely get you 30 pounds in a month. You know, we're the guys that'll say, yeah, there's a good chance that we can probably get you to lose weight, but, you know, it depends on all these variables. And then nobody, you know, they don't work with the guy that, you know, guarantees the weight loss. So if you want guarantees and specifics, this is just a bad webinar for you. But if you want to understand what the research really says, then I'm happy to share, you know, everything that I've read and learned over the past, you know, few 5 years of topics.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've, for better or for worse, I've sort of learned that, like, we don't really know, and it's super complicated, and here's a bunch of, like, technical information is not necessarily the best type of marketing, but I still just kind of keep saying that anyway. I can't help it.
Yeah, I'm right with you. So, yeah, we can keep working in obscurity together then.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess I thought maybe it'd be good to start with talking a little bit about lab work and then go into overtraining, because some of the overtraining pieces might tie back into some of the lab work stuff. So laying a good groundwork of lab work information is probably helpful. So again, with lab work, you know, I think a starting point is like, let's talk about what your doctor is looking for, because the real question is, or the question a lot of people have is, are the labs that your doctor's not running valuable at all? And so I think you have to start with the context of what is your doctor running and why are they running that? And, you know, under most circumstances, your doctor only gets a few minutes with you. So they have to prioritize. And the tests that they're running are typically negotiated through insurance companies based on like cost benefit analysis. They're looking at like major bodily systems. They want to make sure that your organs are working. They want to make sure that you're not showing signs of leading causes of death, you know, heart disease, metabolic dysfunction, and all these the sort of things that they can check the box on pretty quickly and get you out the door. That's roughly what you're experiencing when you go to the doctor and they run those tests on you. But you know, not everybody feels like avoiding heart disease is the bar that they want to set for their health. And especially like within our little bubble of fitness, a lot of people want to think about optimizing their nutrition or whatever. You know, they want to supplement or design their training specifically for what their outcomes. And, you know, there's a lot of good research behind that, but that's, I think, what brings people into running these tests that are not what their doctor's running. So, you know, that's kind of a lot of the things that we wanted to talk about on this section of the webinar is, are these tests that your doctor's not running worthwhile? So, you know, understanding the incentives of the insurance company and the doctors is really an important piece of that, because if you don't understand their incentives, then you don't really understand like why they're running what they're running, why there are these other options, and why you might want to consider them. And whether or not they work is a whole other, or provide valuable information is a whole other series of questions. But we are seeing this trend of people wanting to take their health into their own hands and running more lab work. And so you see things like the growth of, you know, genetic testing, like 23andMe, for instance. Tons of people are running those labs now. And I think that a lot of people are selling answers based upon those test results that are, you know, some shaky science at best. And have you had anybody come into your gym and be like, I had this lab test done, it looked at my genetics and it said that I'm supposed to do, you know, cardio for fat loss, or like, I don't metabolize carbohydrates very well, so you know, I'm going to eat a low fat diet or a high fat diet or something like that. You know, there's all this information that people are trying to collect now because it's out there and makes sense of. But I think that by and large, we don't really have solid answers to it. You know, we're doing some guessing. We're kind of in that early phase. If you think about technology, there's early adopters and they get things and they're buggy and they break and they, whatever. That's kind of the phase that we are in of this at home and outside of the medical establishment type testing. which doesn't mean that there isn't some benefit to it. But I think that you should, just as Todd is, be skeptical about most of what is being run and being looked at. But with that said, you know, there's this whole, for instance, nutrient testing is something that's becoming more popular. And I worked at this NFL combine camp like maybe 5 years ago or so, and we were working with these guys that had been invited to the combine, and they were trying to, you know, get everything dialed in right before going to the combine. And one of the things that they ran on those guys was this huge nutrient panel, and it was super cool and blew me away. And it was one of the things that got me interested in pursuing this path of research, because they were looking at, like, I don't know, copper status and vitamin status and things that I'd never seen before. And they were telling me that if, you know, you change this, that, or the other, like, this guy's going to have a hard time conceiving a kid, and this guy's results are going to be worse because of these nutrients. And I was fascinated by it. And I think that there actually is some really legitimate science behind those nutrients now. Todd, you and I think are both fans of Chris Masterjohn's work, and he recently released a guide on interpreting nutrient status testing results, and like how to respond to them, and the things that they might, like if you have certain nutrient or in excess, what that might mean for you. And I actually purchased, he's got some sort of PDF guide that's like $20 and worth like $20,000 worth of education. So I think that anybody that's interested in understanding their nutrient status, like that's something that we've got real science behind. We've got, you know, very serious researchers reviewing all the science and making sense of it and putting it in digestible packages so that we can use it both as coaches and as individuals if people are out there and they want to understand that stuff. Did you see the nutrient guide that you put together?
Yeah, I did. It's like you said, it's very dense. It's very interesting. and I think one of the things that, you know, is a question that I have, and that I think that a lot of, I guess, clients have confusion surrounding, is, you know, if we do notice, let's say, some discrepancies in nutrient status or something that may look like it needs to be improved upon, at what point are those potentially major limiting factors, and at what point are they incremental changes? Right? Does that make sense? Because I think that a lot of time, you know, you get clients who are, they're very concerned with like, oh, I think that, you know, my levels are off, and I think I'm low in selenium, and that's screwing up my thyroid, and that's why I can't lose weight. It's like,
right, dude,
you like just eat whatever you want every weekend. Like, yeah. it's not your thyroid, man. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, and I think that a lot of times people are looking for this is like an effective sort of magic pill type of solution where people want to say, oh, I'm stuck in the gym because I'm not consuming enough vitamin A or something. Like they want some sort of magic answer as to why they're not losing fat or their numbers aren't going up or something. And I think that by and large, a lot of these nutrient things are more minor, at least in the short term. Over the long term, they can lead to major problems. Like magnesium deficiency, for instance, is associated with all sorts of, you know, like metabolic condition, heart disease, those sort of things. And again, it's not causal, it's associated with it, but roughly 50% of the US population is deficient in magnesium. So there are things where nutrient deficiencies over time can turn into major deals. But if they were like immediate, major, serious, house on fire type of problems, they would be the things that your doctor would be running as a part of that quick panel that they're doing when you go visit them. So I think that a lot of this nutrient stuff is probably more appropriate for people that, one, are interested, like have their training dialed in, have their nutrition pretty buttoned up, like are sleeping well, have all these other pieces in place, and then they want to take it to the next level. Or maybe they go to the doctor and they, you know, all of their major markers and systems seem to be functioning fine, but they've got some symptoms that are, they don't know the answer to, like that just don't come up within the context of those tests that they're running. Then, you know, I mean, it's entirely possible it's psychological too, but they may get some new answers from that. Like, for instance, a lot of times we'll see people that have fatigue due to iron deficiencies, and the iron panels that end up getting run with the doctor are usually pretty limited. And there you can run much more comprehensive iron panels. And I've seen this where people will get, people will get the iron coming back from the simple test that their doctor ran and it comes back normal. But when we run the more comprehensive panel, we do see dysfunction. And so maybe it's just another year or two away from driving that number that the doctor's looking at out of bounds. But because we took a deeper look at it, then we've got more information to make some informed choices and improve their diet or, you know, maybe supplementation or something to improve the way that they're feeling. Because again, not everybody wants to set the bar at feeling mediocre and not having disease. Some people like want to feel great. And this can be a part of that.
Yeah. So we had a question pop up in terms of actually getting the correct lab work, I suppose, and where one would go to actually get this type of lab work done, which I think is also pretty relevant, right? Because, I mean, it's like, that's a whole confusing mess as well. So if you are in the boat of like, okay, cool, I think this is something I'd like to dig into, I'd like to go deeper on this, you know, tangible action step, what do? You can't just show up at the doctor and be like, hello, like, please check me.
Well, and I mean, doctors, they've got those, the tests that they run, the standard battery, tend to be attached to what the insurance says that they'll cover, right? And so if you show up and you say, hey, I want you to look at these obscure iron markers, they're going to say no, because either that or you're going to have to pay out of pocket for it, which all of that lab testing is super expensive when you have to pay out of pocket. So if the question is, you know, how do I get the testing run? Well, it depends on what we're testing, right? Because you could just do like a shotgun approach. You know, there are companies out there like Wellness FX, for instance, that has some massive panel that you can pay $1,000 for or something and get a lot more information than what your doctor is running. But for instance, when I'm working with clients, I will recommend that they run lab work, run tests are tightly associated with the symptoms that they're exhibiting. So, you know, if this is an asymptomatic person, like somebody that, you know, wants to compete in CrossFit and they want to just make sure everything is totally in line, then yeah, maybe you just do one of those big shotgun approach panels and you get all the data and then try to improve the things that are going to move the needle the most. But for somebody that's just maybe not quite feeling well or perfect, then that's a tougher question. And you know, if this person, if they're curious, I can probably point them in the right direction. If they want to shoot me an email, they're welcome to do so. They can email brandon@evidencebasedathlete.com and I'll try to point you in the right direction. And I should also, I guess, preface at this point that neither you or I are doctors. So we're talking about lab work and recommendations around this stuff, carefully, people. We just play doctors on the internet. Okay. So hopefully that answered that person's question. Feel free, anybody that has any questions, drop them in as we get here so that, you know, Todd and I aren't just rambling about what we feel about talking about. The other quick thing about the lab work and the traditional things that are being run is this whole notion of reference ranges. And it's pretty interesting. So like, you know, one reference range example is fasting glucose. So fasting glucose is one thing that they use to try to track people's progression into diabetes. And they'll say, you know, your fasting glucose is under 100, you're fine. You are 100 to 120, okay, you have prediabetes. And you're over 120, okay, you have type 2 diabetes. Now, I'm not criticizing all doctors. I think that your mileage will vary dramatically with your doctor, but I've definitely seen lab work where someone will come and show me the results that they had from their doctor and it'll be like fasting glucose 99 or something. And so 99 is okay, but 101 is bad. And you have to think about how arbitrary like 1 point is, if that's even within the realm of precision of this measurement. You know, it's silly to think about these lab results and how arbitrary the end of the reference range might be. A lot of these reference ranges, the fasting glucose is not an example of this, but a lot of the reference ranges are based on statistical measures of the data that the labs are collecting. So, you know, they test me and they test Todd and then they test everybody, you know, everybody in America. then they're going to define a lot of the statistical ranges based upon that data. So it's going to be like maybe 20% to 80% range. That'll be the reference range. So it's not, reference ranges aren't necessarily based upon what's healthy. Not always. I mean, sometimes they try to map that in. But I think that's something that people don't necessarily realize, is that often they're based upon statistical measures of data that the lab is collecting. And sometimes it's hard to step outside this fitness bubble where we all sit and say that most of the people, the average person in America, is not somebody that I want to necessarily compare myself against. So that's not a fair judgment across all lab markers, but it's another thing to consider. And so I think there's been this alternate approach to map these, you know, functional ranges on reference ranges. And so the idea being that these functional ranges are like what's healthy, and the reference ranges are what's, you know, the lab reference ranges are like just the statistical measures. But again, now we've got another set of problems where a lot of times these functional ranges are just people that are narrowing the reference range arbitrarily, and it's not based on health or anything of that nature. So you have to be kind of careful. And like I said, I'd love to be able to tell you guys, oh, just go run this test and then use these reference ranges and that's the answer. But I think, like I said, we're very early on all of this, and there's just no good solution. I mean, outside of like talking to somebody that knows what they're talking about, or, you know, knows, is confused about it, but just a little bit less confused than you are, or, you know, has at least done some research on the topic.
I think a question that I have that might be helpful for sort of thinking about this is, you know, you have, we talked already about some nutrient markers, right? So that you talked about like an iron panel. We could look at something like, let's say, vitamin D, or I think we mentioned like blood selenium levels, blood copper levels, all those kinds of things, which are potentially reflective of the actual status of minerals and nutrients like that that are in the body, right? Then you also mentioned something like blood glucose, or we could look at something like, let's say, testosterone or thyroid levels or things like that, which are likely more of like a downstream effect, right? Where, you know, it's not just like, oh, your blood glucose levels are high, so we need to like do X, Y, Z. It's like, okay, well, what's actually potentially causing that to happen? Whereas there may be a more, you know, simple, actionable, step based upon like a nutrient level. So, I mean, I guess how do you think about those things in terms of like, okay, are you looking at these lab tests as something that can result in making a recommendation, or is it something that you look at more as just a global indicator that it's like a check engine light? Like, okay, something's up. Like, we don't know what it is, but maybe we should try to figure it out.
I think that it's more the latter. Because even with simple things like vitamin D, you mentioned, actually being a hormone, it has a complicated relationship with the body, and its absorption is not necessarily standalone. There are other things that we can test for that can help us understand what's going on with vitamin D. I think that for most of this new this lab testing, it's more about not looking at any individual marker, but to look at what we're seeing, what the bigger picture is when it comes back. Like, if I get a whole bunch of lab results back and I see one thing out of bounds, that's one conclusion, and that doesn't really give you that much. Maybe that's, let's just supplement with a little bit of vitamin D to see what happens. If I do another set of testing and I see like, you know, fasting glucose is elevated and triglycerides are elevated, and we see all these sort of markers of metabolic dysfunction, then, you know, that tells a more complete story. But just looking at one marker, it doesn't tell you the answer. Like fasting glucose, for instance, you know, you maybe just exercised before you went and did your test, and that might, you know, send it off to the sky. There are a number of things that can drive those markers out of bounds. And so any one marker is really difficult to rely on its own. And I think that a lot of times too, these markers, like I was saying, the arbitrary nature of them being like 99 healthy and 101 unhealthy pre-diabetic in the case of fasting glucose, time is something that's mostly been neglected as far as these lab results go. And I think that maybe it's been because it's more difficult to track it. Now that we're moving on to electronic health records, we're going to get more of this. But you know, if I 2 years ago had a fasting glucose of 85, and then last year I had one of 90, and then this year I'm at 95, even though I'm still technically within the healthy range, that pattern tells us something. So pattern, you know, the temporal piece of this is something that I think has been neglected, and it's not just relevant to fasting glucose, it's relevant to a lot of our lab testing. And I think that if we're able to plot that stuff over time, we can pull out a lot more information and catch these problems that might crop up, disease or whatever, way further in advance than we are capable of doing or have previously been capable of doing.
So another question I have, so let's use that glucose example. How sensitive, I mean, I imagine this varies across different lab tests as well, but how sensitive is, let's say, a glucose lab test to simply like the conditions on that day, right? Like, I mean, what's the standard deviation for a blood glucose measurement? Because it may be something, you know, you think about something in the gym where, say, an athlete has a max back squat of 405 and they build to a max for the day. And, you know, there's a chance, depending on any number of factors, that they'll probably get somewhere between, let's say, 380 and 425, right?
Right.
Just based upon having a max of, theoretical max of 405, where it's like, okay, we don't know what that actually means. We have no idea if that was like the best day ever for you, and that's your true max physiological potential. If that was a quote unquote bad day for you, you know, and your ability to repeat that type of effort is going to be pretty variable. And athletes have a hard time understanding that. They're like, oh my God, I'm worse. They're like, oh, that was a huge PR today. And it's like, well, we don't actually know if you got any better based upon that. So, you know, let's say your blood glucose was 85 and then it was 90 and then it was 95. Does that mean that potentially your blood glucose just hangs out between 85 and 95 all the time and it's nothing to be concerned with? Or is that something that you would actually be concerned with?
Yeah, I mean, it very well could be, right? But I think that seeing that trend isn't indicative of I have a problem, but it is indicative of let's take a closer look at what's happening. So, you know, if I see that trend happening, 85, 90, 95, sure, and we could have just got unlucky with our sampling. There could just be variation in that. You know, maybe the person, like a car pulled out in front of them right before they did the test and they slammed on the brake, which released cortisol and liberated glucose. And so then their, you know, their blood glucose level is super elevated and they freak out because they're pre-diabetic, but really it doesn't mean anything. It just gives us one piece of information then to then expand our investigation. And so if I saw that with somebody, then I might say, okay, let's take a look at your A1C level and see what's happening there. And A1C is meant to be like this average, longer term average of what the blood glucose is. And it comes with its own set of problems. And I think that's why we can't really trust any one marker. And we have to look at the larger picture. And that involves more than, you know, it involves looking at many markers and not just mark, because there's a tendency for people to get hung up on what the labs are saying, but you know, also figure out like how are they feeling, what are their symptoms if they have any. All of those pieces of information together is so much more powerful than just looking at a number on a sheet of paper. You know, creatinine, for instance, is a measure of like muscle catabolism in the body, and so we can see people that are more muscular and like in fitness, they'll have elevated creatinine levels. And so without that piece of information, we might say, hey, you're having some sort of kidney dysfunction because this marker is elevated. But in reality, the context is work out a lot and you've got a lot of muscle mass. And so that just is naturally a higher level. So, you know, any one marker is very difficult to hang your hat on. I don't know if that answered the question, but it's information to further the investigation and maybe do some personal experimentation based upon.
Yeah, for sure. What about, I mean, I think the numbers that people are always obsessed with are things like testosterone and estrogen and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, one of the things that I think is grayer than people realize is how much these numbers actually reflect a change in something that people care about, where people think that if they elevate their testosterone levels, that they will perform better and they will have better body composition and all that kind of stuff. You know, but to me, I think it's more unclear whether or not there is an actual correlation with quote unquote results with these lab levels, right? That obviously there's a super physiological level at which, you know, you get performance enhancing benefits. Otherwise people wouldn't be shooting themselves in the butt with testosterone. But, right. You know, when you're dealing with just kind of like natural levels and variations in that, what is the relationship, if any, with results that people care about?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult bringing up testosterone. It's really difficult to move the needle on that. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's sold that elevates testosterone and pretty much none of it does anything at all. Especially at a level that makes what we, you know, clinical significance. So maybe there's something that has a statistical improvement of like 0.1%. Like, we know that this one thing will improve your testosterone 0.1%, but so that's statistically significant. That thing actually works, but is it clinically significant? Does it mean anything to you? And I think that by and large with testosterone especially, it doesn't. But we're not necessarily testing to see the testosterone to see like where you, like if you're 10% lower than the average. I really haven't seen any research or things you can do in response to that would make any difference. But if we're testing and we see that testosterone is like below the reference range, which accounts for people, for men that are like in their 80s, which, you know, is another thing about reference ranges, is that with testosterone, it decreases over time. And so the reference range is based upon like 20 year old guys and 80 year old guys. And they really have different testosterone levels. But if we see that a 20 year old guy has lab low testosterone, then that's an investigation that we need to pursue. But again, that like goes down this whole other rabbit hole of like, is it total testosterone? Is it free testosterone? And understanding if it's just like they're producing enough testosterone, but it's getting all bound up or what. So it's pretty difficult and to do much based upon that. You know, I think that people, you mentioned in the outline for this that we talk about a sort of chiro pseudoscience type of thing. And I think that people get these hormone measurements done, especially in things like saliva, where the validation of the measurement isn't necessarily awesome. You know, estrogen, for instance, in saliva is it occurs at like a very small percentage of what we see it in the rest of the body, in the urine or in the blood. And so when we're using saliva to look at estrogen, we can't really make meaningful interpretations of it, because we can look at data from postmenopausal women and premenopausal women and see that they're basically coming in within the same error bars. So it's really difficult to do much with these, except for at a course level where people are very low relative to where they should be or very high relative to where they should be. And then, you know, making some inferences based on that.
Can you elaborate on some of the differences between salivary hormone testing, blood hormone testing, and urine hormone testing? Because I think that, you know, that's something that is pretty confusing to people. And also depending on what kind of practitioner you work with, whether it's, you know, a doctor, like a medical doctor versus, let's say, a chiropractor versus a naturopath, and versus like a health coach or someone who's like a functional diagnostic nutrition certified person, that all these people are running different kinds of tests, and that there can be a lot of, sort of like you mentioned, overlap or even severe misalignment, where it's like, okay, I spat in a tube and it told me that I have super low testosterone, but then I got a blood test and it told me this, and then I'm pissing out some metabolites of something. And I think that can be just really messy for people to understand, you know, why they would do one type of test over another, and then what kinds of actions you would even potentially take based upon those tests.
Yeah, so the form that you take the measurement, you know, that varies what you're actually looking at. So like you mentioned, you know, looking in blood or looking in saliva or looking in urine, you're very likely looking at slightly different forms of the same things. And so the correlation between, and then, you know, ultimately what they're trying to do is correlate that back to what's happening in your body. Sometimes it's a good approximation and sometimes it's not. And we're all motivated to do the types of testing that we do because of the system, the healthcare system that we have in place. You know, the Kairos, for instance, they'll run the saliva testing because they can't run blood testing. You know, blood testing has to be signed off on by a doctor. Stool testing has to be signed off by a doctor. But saliva testing, anybody can run it. So that's why you might have somebody pushing saliva. But that's not to say that saliva is bad. Like, I don't want to put that in the corner. I think that the cortisol discussion, cortisol, you know, being this hormone that people like to refer to as the stress hormone, is informative in this topic because it kind of highlights the differences between what we're seeing in these different measurements. So in saliva, we measure the free form of cortisol. So that's the unbound cortisol in the body. But the thing is that total circulating cortisol the free cortisol only makes up like a few percent of the total circulating cortisol in the body. So when we look in the saliva, we are seeing the unbound amount, which is an important measurement, but it's a very poor measurement for total cortisol production in the body. That's why you'll see people coming and saying that they were diagnosed with like adrenal fatigue as a part of some saliva test that showed them that they were low cortisol. I've seen data on this where it's been demonstrated that as little as 15% of the people that have low free cortisol actually have low metabolized levels. And metabolized levels make up over 80% of the circulating cortisol in the body. So what we're doing is we're telling people through the saliva testing sometimes that they have low cortisol, and then trying to make recommendations and changes in their supplementation and lifestyle based upon it, when in fact they may have high cortisol. That discordant pattern is not uncommon at all. And I do see it in regular lab work. So when we look at cortisol in the blood, we're talking cortisol, which is like, you know, the sum of the free cortisol and the bound cortisol. It's everything. And there are ways, there are additional tests to try to work out into a calculation on the free cortisol based on blood, but it's much less common. So if you see a blood cortisol level, it's a measure of your total circulating cortisol. So that's kind of the difference between the blood and the saliva. With urine, we can see metabolites, like you mentioned. So in urine, we can get both the free cortisol and we can get the metabolized cortisol. So it's a really interesting measurement when it comes to cortisol and understanding what's happening, because it gives us both pieces. We can understand, you know, for instance, with low free cortisol and high total cortisol, that's a common pattern for people that are developing metabolic dysfunction, insulin resistance, those sort of things. And then if we see people with high free cortisol and normal or low metabolized cortisol, that's a pattern that's pretty consistent with thyroid dysfunction, high thyroid. So just, I don't know, last month I had a client, we looked at these hormones in their urine, and I saw that discordant pattern and had them go to their doctor and run some additional thyroid testing. They did. The doctor then diagnosed them as hypothyroid and started medicating them based upon that. So you know, there are ways to extract valuable information from each of these types of measurements, but you just have to understand the differences between them and how we can apply them to you know, like what's going on in the body and understanding that type of thing. I don't know, did that address your question?
Yeah, for sure. I think that was super helpful and insightful. And I think something else that would be helpful, I guess, can you just clarify the difference between, like, let's say free cortisol and metabolized cortisol? And then potentially even elaborate on that relative to, like, let's say sex hormones, where you kind of have like free testosterone and then you have potentially bound testosterone, all that kind of stuff. So I think just a rough overview of that could really help people understand, you know, why some lab tests, you know, are pieces of valuable information, but are difficult to actually make recommendations based upon.
Yeah. So like in the case of free cortisol, just staying with that, you know, free cortisol is basically the it's unbound by protein. So it's the bioactive form of this hormone in the body. So like we're using cortisol as part of our stress response. If we have a strong stress response that produces, you know, the adrenals produce this high level of free cortisol, then our body is able to capitalize on that hormone. Whereas if we have a high level of circulating metabolized cortisol or bound up cortisol, it's basically bound up by these proteins. And depending on a whole series of other things, it's kind of a simplification to say that it's effectively like an inactive form of that hormone. So it can be a good proxy for total production of the hormone, but it's being bound up, and that's something that is an additional piece of information that we then can try to make sense of.
So we probably have some folks on watching who are either competitive CrossFit athletes or coaches of competitive CrossFit athletes. So would you expect then, let's say, a competitive athlete who's training at intensity regularly to potentially have high levels of metabolized cortisol but low levels of free cortisol? Would that be a common pattern?
I mean, honestly, I see these labs for people that are competitive and everyday people, and they're all over the map. You know, they're oftentimes like we'll see these young people, competitive CrossFitters, you know, you're 20 something, 22 years old. They have a strong free cortisol response, and you know, they their production is good. Maybe their total is high as well, but because they're so, you know, resilient, they haven't spent, you know, 30 years like eating shitty and sleeping shitty and exposing themselves to high levels of psychological stressors, they tend to have more healthy responses. Whereas over time, we can see people developing this dysfunction within their HPA axis, and similar patterns can emerge, like higher total cortisol and cortisol resistance, and you know, those sort of patterns, which mimic like insulin resistance, which is something that a lot of people are familiar with. Those develop usually with much longer time exposure. But you know, we can definitely see that within competitive CrossFitters, any age, but maybe especially those that are up in the master's divisions, for instance. But it's hard to really put any one person in a particular bucket based on their results. It's mostly just like taking a look at the results and then you know, trying to map whether or not they are relatively they're responding relatively well based on their context of being an athlete. You know, another thing that both the saliva and the urine cortisol testing gives us, which is helpful for understanding how people are like long-term health, that's connected with long-term health and even performance, is this diurnal cortisol pattern. You know, people are supposed to have this elevated level of cortisol when they wake up. It's part of what gets them up and gets them going. And then throughout the day, that level declines. And so you can't really get the blood, because you're not going to be getting blood drawn, you know, four times a day, right when you wake up, right before you go to bed and stuff. So you can do this saliva testing and the urine testing four times a day, and you can get this pattern, and you can understand how healthy of a function that individual has. And at first, I think that this was sort of pseudo-esque science, but I think over time we've developed an understanding of how important that circadian rhythm is. And now they're doing research using the salivary testing to connect this dysfunctional diurnal patterns with later onset cognitive disorders like dementia, you know, Alzheimer's and that sort of thing. And honestly, like I get a lot of clients too that are shift workers, firefighters and so forth. And so they'll have this really wacky shape. Instead of high in the morning and, you know, low at night, maybe it'll be flat, or maybe it'll be high at night and low in the morning. And I mean, shift work is a whole other kettle of fish. I don't know if you've worked with many people that do shift work, but man, they've got bad. Like I know that oftentimes they're serving jobs that are very important to our society, but I'm not sure that people understand how bad they are sacrificing their personal health for that. I had one client recently that like a year ago, his A1C, which is the average of his fasting blood glucose, just like year after year after year, was continuing to ramp up. And he was in the pre-diabetic range, continuing to, you know, get closer and closer to that diabetic diagnosis. And he was doing these 24-hour shifts, 4 days off. He's a firefighter. I was hammering on him about this, you know, how unhealthy it is, so on and so forth. Eventually, he had an opportunity come up where he worked regular 5 days shifts during the day. And within a couple of months of doing that, he came up to his annual physical again with work, and his A1C had dropped straight back down to the normal range. Just to think, like, how much betraying our natural patterns as humans can just like cause a shit show inside of us.
Yeah, that circadian rhythm, I think, is pretty severely underrated by a lot of people, right? Relative to when you eat, when you sleep, when you exercise, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. That I think people really underweight how important that is, just in terms of how they feel on a daily basis, and then also, you know, what their health looks like over time based upon that, I guess, just that the body's rhythm. So something else that I think that is really relevant here is, you know, as we think about these folks who are athletes, who are trying to push their bodies and maximize their performance, you know, we have this concept we've kind of touched on a few times of overtraining, or some people, you know, come in and say, hey, you know, I think I have adrenal fatigue, whatever. I personally joke about adrenal fatigue all the time. Every time, you know, I'm tired or not feeling so good, it's like, oh man, I definitely fatigue the adrenals. I think we're in trouble now. You know, very clearly, like anecdotally and empirically, there is some sort of negative adaptation to stress over time that can happen to folks who are trying to push their bodies in the gym. From your perspective, you know, what is actually going on here, and what can, you know, we do as coaches to potentially help people who have experienced that or are experiencing those types of symptoms?
Well, right. So coaches, I mean, you just have to understand how much these have their foot on the gas pedal, and they need to, as the athletes, people need to understand that what they're doing, their training, is not something that's aligned with health. And so as a coach, your job is basically to show them that sweet spot where they can, as hard as possible, maximize their performance and not die, right? So it's a tough balance, and I think that it's a lot less running this and a lot more about just getting to know your clients and understanding how they're responding to how hard you're pushing them. Because usually, as a coach, your experience with the client, your interaction with the clients, are mostly training based. I mean, you probably have some inputs on their diet, but most of what you're seeing is probably centered around their training. And as far as overtraining goes, you know, I think the first step before you even consider asking them to run lab work, and I mean, keep in mind, I'm somebody that makes a part of my living running lab work and working with people on it. I don't think that it's the best first step. I think as coaches, you just need to understand, how hard am I pushing them, and how are they responding to that training? Because, you know, training, we're supposed to basically, you know, push them and to an adaptation, and then, you know, just continue to repeat that. And there's a common notion within training to push people within this periodized sense into a time frame of overreaching, and then doing some sort of deload, and then, you know, continuing to repeat that. Is that something that on your higher level athletes, Todd, you use as a framework?
It depends. I would say that I'm probably more cautious now with that type of thing than I have been in the past. That I've become more of a fan of having people do a lot of stuff that's like kind of easier, and then a few things that are really hard, and not really hammering them anywhere near as much. Simply based upon, you know, understanding some of these concepts, as well as seeing results for people over time being the same, if not better, with I guess kind of a more high-low type of training perspective, right? Rather than saying, okay, we're gonna do a really hard block and then kind of back off, and then do a really hard block and then kind of back off, that I sort of favor now more having a few very high effort days and then a few really easy days, and that people actually tend to feel quite a bit better over time based upon that. So they don't need as much, I guess, like overreach, back off in a, like a big picture training cycle, because they're sort of, they're not hitting as much volume and intensity in, like, let's say a week, relative to what they could potentially tolerate. Although that said, in a sport like CrossFit, once you run into something like the Open, you know that every year it's going to be like, okay, this is just going to wreck people, right? After these 5 weeks, even if they are moving on to regionals, like, they have to just calm down for a little bit, because, you know, everyone gets sick the last week of the Open. They feel terrible. They're exhausted. They're burnt out. They don't want to come to the gym. And those are probably the types of, you know, feelings and symptoms that you might get in an overreach / overtrained state.
Yeah. The, you know, as far as like, if we just cut to the chase on this overtraining thing, we're just kind of getting out. A lot of people talk about a lot of different markers. They look at the stress markers. They're looking at testosterone to cortisol ratios. And they're looking at all sorts of things. And we've seen research that kind of indicates that maybe overtraining can be indicated by some of these things, but it's not really, it hasn't matured to the point where we can really use it. The things that are most mature when it comes to overtraining are these psychological effects to training. It's when people are feeling crappy, they're losing motivation, when they they're irritable, they get angry, they're angrier than normal. Those are the symptoms that are most validated search as being connected to overtraining. So, you know, I would say that if you're continuing to have clients monitor their psychological status, maybe just like, what's my motivation today for training, and what's my, like, what do I feel? How do I feel? Like, maybe what my energy level is. You know, just a few markers that then they track that with their training. And then you just, as a coach, kind of look at for patterns in that. That will be instrumental into understanding this whole overtraining, overreaching thing. And if you're getting a lot of these days where people are not feeling great psychologically, then you know that you need to back off a little bit. That's just what needs to happen in order for them to continue to respond.
Yeah. And do you have any insight into what may mechanistically be going on with these types of overtraining states? I mean, obviously, like you just said, it's difficult to really pinpoint it just based simply upon markers, right? But I mean, we sort of have the classic framework of adrenal fatigue, which, you know, we sort of poke some fun at as far as like, oh, you just like, you wore out your adrenals and they can't produce cortisol anymore. And, you know, now you have adrenal fatigue, which, you know, I think we said before is kind of a bunch of bullshit. But, you know, do you have any insight into mechanistically what might be happening to these athletes as they reach this state where they're not feeling so good?
It's really hard to say. Like, all of the research is mixed. And the problem is, I think one of the major problems is that, first of all, when we're trying to put together research on overtraining, it's considered unethical to push people into a state where you could be doing damage to them, right? So this is taking people beyond overreaching and putting them into overtraining. So it's hard to get a study approved where you're saying we may inflict long-term damage into these clients so that we can understand the physiological reasons and underpinnings behind overtraining. So not a lot of the overtraining research is conducted. The research, the studies that we do have, it's much less clear if they're being overtrained at all, right? So we'll say, okay, here's an overtraining study. And they'll say, okay, we looked at cortisol to testosterone ratio, and we didn't find any significant trends. Now, the question becomes like, one, were these people actually overtrained? Like, how, what we're doing is trying to find out what's driving overtraining by training them, but we have no way to tell that they're overtrained. So we don't know if they're over, it's just this big circle that we run around. So that's really the fundamental problem with all of this research. And we're learning so much and trying to pull out all these markers and look for the magic wand. But the problem is like just fundamental with the research that we can't know if we're overtraining them. So, you know, people are looking at things like heart rate variability, which is showing some promise. They're looking at some of these hormone markers, but none of them meet the standard for, you know, what would be considered as like capable of using as diagnosis. In fact, overtraining is considered to be a diagnosis of exclusion, which is basically saying, okay, somebody is not performing in the gym, because that's the one criteria that they use in research for categorizing overtraining, right? Is their performance is stalled in the gym. So they say, all right, their performance is stalled in the gym. Are they sick? Do they have any other diseases? Is anything else going on? If not, they're overtrained. So that's how they're classifying overtraining in the research. And I think that that's why we're not seeing clear trend, or part of the reason why we're not seeing clear trends. And so, you know, I'd love to be able to tell you that it's because, you know, there's a dip in testosterone and affects your mood and whatever, but it's not there. And you mentioned, I mean, you kind of talked about adrenal fatigue a couple of times here. And so it might be worth just commenting on that. You know, first and foremost, it's not a medical condition. If you go on PubMed and you search for adrenal fatigue, there's like 5-10 things that come up. So this whole notion that you exhaust your adrenal capacity to produce cortisol is really just—it's errant. It's not something that's found in literature. But with that said, I think that it also kind of misses the point a little bit, because it's kind—it really parallels this overtraining thing really well. Because that's to say, we can't define overtraining in the literature, so it must not exist. We know these pieces exist. If you look up HPA axis dysfunction in PubMed, you're gonna get tons of results. And HPA axis is hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. So we do see dysfunction within the axis. It's just not this thing where you're in stage 3 adrenal fatigue and you're reached exhaustion and you can't produce cortisol anymore. It might be that you've had like prolonged chronic exposure to stress, and now your body is desensitized to the cortisol that you're producing. So then it has to upregulate it. Or, I mean, any number of things. That's just one example of it. That's my thoughts on that.
I think that something that would be, I guess, helpful and valuable is, I guess, just some actionable takeaways for folks who are potentially concerned, you know, that either they may be reaching this state of overtraining, or that athletes who they're working with may be reaching this state of overtraining. I mean, we already sort of discussed the idea of just understanding your mood and how you feel and whether or not you want to be in the gym and whether your results make any sense relative to what you have historically been capable of, right? Which, I mean, as you sort of said, is probably the best way to realize if something is wrong. And that lab work may be something that helps that, that understanding, or sort of confirms that, hey, listen, like, you don't feel good, you don't look good, everything is kind of not going so well, and your testosterone is lower than it used to be, and your blood glucose is higher than it used to be, maybe there's something right. going on. But, you know, what would you recommend, I guess, for someone who is interested and curious as far as, like, prioritizing what they should think about and what they should work on? Because I think that people get caught in this thing where they're like, uh-oh, I need to maximize my performance, and, like, maybe I didn't do as well in the open as I want to, so I'm going to check my Whoop, and I'm going to get a nutrient panel, and I'm going to track my macros, and I'm going to wellness effects blood work done, and I'm going to do compression boots every day. Right?
Okay. Yeah. And then don't really even use any of that information after they get it, right?
Yeah.
No, I get it. I mean, that's easy. Like, that's the quick fix, right? It's the thing that you can do, or you can spend $400 and get a Whoop, and then you're good, right? I mentioned it before, but I think that the first thing that people have to do is keep a training log where they're rating their perceived exertion for the day, their workout duration, and how they're feeling, like aches and pains and fatigue, how you slept. And, you know, they can throw in things like early morning heart rate if they want, like if they want to, like, put some numbers on it. But I think rating those things like 1 to 5 on a daily basis can be very enlightening and reflective. And you can say, well, I just know that I don't feel worse. But when you don't pay attention to something, you don't measure it, then you really just sort of end up ignoring it. So I think that at a first level, at a first pass, bottom line, you have to do that. Beyond that, I think that if you're designing training for people, you need to make sure that you have some mechanism in them, in that training, for them to not be foot on the gas pedal all day long or every training session. And, you know, traditionally that's been done through periodic deloads. If you're taking an approach like Todd, I think that's reasonable. It's more like this undulating periodization approach where you're giving them more easy stuff throughout the week so that they can manage with that harder stuff. So it's the same sort of periodization, just like squished into a shorter time period, right? That's effectively what you're doing. And if there is none of that in your training, then I think that if you're an athlete, you need to find something to do these things intelligently and structure them for you, and not just follow like the Invictus blog or whatever training blog out there, because it's not designed for you. And if you're not going to be willing to modulate your training based on how you feel, then you need somebody to do that for you. So I think that that's really important. And then the other thing is, like, if you want to push really hard on your training, you need to pay attention to things like your sleep and your nutrition, because we see one of the things that is speculated in the research that is a driver for overtraining is both people in a hypocaloric state when they're training. So, you know, if you're trying to lose fat but also perform in CrossFit, that's a recipe for disaster. Also, low carbohydrate, your carbohydrate intake needs to at least account for your activity, right? So if you're somebody that is doing this low carbohydrate approach, but you're participating in a heavily glycolytic activity, I'm not aligned with those people that are saying, like, you know, keto and CrossFit is a winning combination. I think that it's a combination to maybe screw you up. Now, we don't have validated research on that, but that's my opinion based on what I have read. And there is some research, the overtraining research, that shows that low carbohydrate intake can exacerbate overtraining. Also, if you think that you've been overtrained, you'd be more careful, because I found one study that looked at collegiate swimmers, and they found that those that got themselves into a position of overtraining within their first season were like 91% more likely to exhibit symptoms of overtraining again in the subsequent three seasons through a school. Whereas the control group, the people that didn't get the overtraining in the first season, were only 34% likely. So, I mean, the first is that we're pushing those college swimmers really hard. But the second thing is that if you have been overtraining, then you probably need to be more careful about it. And then, you know, all that stuff, and you're still feeling like shit, or your performance isn't improving, then that's the time that maybe you want to consider looking deeper and doing lab work. You know, I poked fun at a lot of the different lab tests and showed how a lot of them weren't valuable, but oftentimes we can see levels out of bounds. So we can see the ones of bad things happening, but we can see certain levels out of bounds. And especially in the context of performance, we can then try to do some targeting of those levels that are out of bounds and help effectively put a Band-Aid on somebody so that they can keep pushing, right? Because at the end of the day, like we said, athletics and performance isn't necessarily about health. And there may be a cause for people to just, you know, ball to the wall until they break down and have their competition. So I don't know, those are kind of the basics. And I think that everything else is mostly just fancy, and it's a way to distract you. And it's probably not worth your time or your money.
There you go. A harsh critic of the consumerist fitness business of wearables and supplements and all that.
Look at my room, man. It's empty.
Yeah, exactly. We got minimalist Brandon criticizing marketing, criticizing products. I love it. So Brandon, I mean, I guess, you know, people probably also have some questions just surrounding if they do feel like they have a lot of these pieces dialed and they want to move forward with like, hey, I need someone to potentially help me out here. You know, I mean, you obviously do this as a non-medical professional, but what should they potentially look for, and how would they go about finding someone to guide them through like, hey, listen, like we need to figure out what's going on with you.
Well, when I work with new clients, I all of them on the phone. Like, I won't just do a back and forth email like, hey, you know, I feel like my cortisol is messed up. I think I have adrenal fatigue. Let's rock. I like to get everybody on the phone.
Have some ashwagandha, pal. There you go.
I like to get everybody on the phone and talk to them so that I can understand what's going on. I can understand what they're doing in their training, what their nutrition looks like, what their life stresses look like, all their psychological stressors, so that I can understand the context of that person. And I think that anybody that doesn't do that but offers lab testing is maybe they're just, their approach is more like, oh, this marker is out of range. Let's try to address that marker, which I think we've covered enough in this conversation is not not something I would consider really a valid approach. So the more a person is willing to learn about, I think the better chance they will be able to help you. And then also, I mean, give a guy a break. Like, anybody that says they don't have the answers, like, I have a personal attachment to that, but I think that, you know, give that guy a shot.
There you go. Exactly. If someone sounds like confusing and maybe unsure and like socially awkward, that they're your best bet for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but I mean, literally, like, the people that say, I have the answer, this is the answer, I know your cortisol is this or whatever, that's probably not going to be a good person to work with. So
there you go. Great. Lack of confidence is what you want to be pushing out.
Totally.
So Brandon, any final thoughts before we wrap up for today?
I think that as far as overtraining goes, just make sure that you're knowing that it's multifactorial. It's not just the amount of volume that you do in your training, that all these other pieces of your life affect. And so it's important for you to account for. And I guess just keep in mind that it's something that could affect your long-term health. So don't just write it off and say, it's okay, and then keep training harder and harder, because it's gonna make it worse and worse. And at some point you may get yourself into a corner that's really dark. And it doesn't matter if you're not like a CrossFit athlete, training 2-a-days for 6 days a week or whatever. This can happen. I've seen it happen in, like, you know, moms that train 5 days a week, but they've got all this other shit in their life that adds to their stress and competes with their training for recovery, you know, for their recovery, and can be in this overtraining scenario just as much as, you know, some other person that's competitive. So don't think that you can't be in it just because you're not competitive. And just, you know, pay attention to your body and how you're feeling, and that's it, I guess.
There we go. Sounds great. Yeah, I mean, I think that not to ramble too much longer, but, you know, we talked about a bunch of wearables and all those kinds of things, and I think there can be some value in that. But that, you know, fundamentally, a lot of these aspects come down to you having an understanding and an honest relationship with your own body and how you feel. And that, especially in the sport of CrossFit, people are, you know, probably through some sort of selection bias, there's a bunch of people who are pretty good at ignoring the signals from their own body. Right, that they have a capacity just kind of like suffer and push through, which is potentially valuable in training, potentially valuable in, you know, entrepreneurship or business, of just like, you know what, I'm just going to grind, and like, I don't care how much it hurts, I'm not going to stop. And, you know, pain is just weakness leaving the body, and like other inspirational types of sayings. But that, you know, the population who we work with is skewed so far in that direction that I think a lot of them lose touch with an honest appreciation of how they're feeling. Right. And that, yes, you should have the capacity as an individual to make a decision whether or not you want to listen to that voice. It's kind of like, you know what, maybe this isn't a good idea. Because sometimes it is just bullshit. Sometimes it is just, you know, the sort of like weak little bitch in your head trying to get you to stop working out, you know. But that for a lot of folks who are competing, that they're so far in the other direction from that, where it's like, you need to be able to tell when today is not your day in the gym and modify your training. You need to be able to tell when you're just not hitting the percentages in your strength cycle, and like tell your coach or like switch your program, because just grinding yourself into the ground every single day is not helpful for you.
Yeah. More is not always better. And I think that that's what's lost on a lot of competitors. I know that we keep saying that we're wrapping it up, but there's this really cool study that I'm going to tell you about real quick.
Sounds awesome.
It was a hypertrophy study. And so what they did was they looked at a group of people that did, I think it was like, so I don't know the exact numbers, but they looked at a group of people that did 40 to 60 reps per muscle group over some training intervention, like maybe 12 weeks. And let's say they added 10 pounds muscle. Then the group that did more, they did 80 to 100 reps. They added, let's say, twice as much muscle, like 20 pounds of muscle over that time. And that's not realistic. That's very high. But you know what I'm saying? They added like twice as much muscle. And then the third group that they looked at was like the 100 plus reps per muscle group. And the crazy thing was that group had the same muscle gain as the group that did the least amount of reps. So there is a sweet spot in training. Doing more isn't better, isn't always better. And so just because there's another guy out there grinding harder than you, that doesn't mean that you have to equally grind, because your performance may be better if you pay attention to this stuff.
There you go. Science says. Science says, don't do all your reps. All right, Brandon, thanks for educating us and cutting through all the pseudoscience and hype.
Yeah, I think with
uncertainty and waffling and flip-flopping.
I cut a very dull butternut.
Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. All right, well, I appreciate you having me on. This was fun. And thanks, man.
All right, cool, guys. Thanks for watching. Replay will be posted sometime in the next day or so as well. Great.
All right.